brow furrowed. "Where'd you find him, Christian?" the small man asks the animal trainer. "Holding hands with Goliath," Christian nods at Will. "That Sasquatch urine probably saved your life. He might have bit off your arm, but I think he was confused." Will nods weakly.
"Lucky."
More people are slipping out from their curtained berths, gawking at Will, as if he were a circus attraction for all to see. "How'd you get into our cars?" the short man asks.
"I ran over top. Your elephant lifted me down."
"Elfrida," says Christian fondly.
"You jumped cars at night?" Mr. Beaupré asks.
Will nods and sees a slow spread of admiration across the giant's features.
"Says there's a man trying to kill him," Christian says dubiously.
A wiry fellow in an undershirt rushes in from the rear of the car.
"Brakeman coming," he whispers urgently. "Seems angry."
Christian frowns.
"They're not supposed to come in here. What have you been up to?"
Before Will can protest, Christian grabs his arm and pulls him forward. Hurriedly, they cross to another car. This corridor here has no curtains, only doors. As they approach one of them, it opens before Christian can raise his knuckles. The dignified form of Mr. Dorian emerges, wrapped in a silk robe.
"Mr. Dorian!"
Will exclaims with a rush of relief. The ringmaster ignores him and says to Christian,
"Bring him inside."
Will is pushed roughly into the stateroom. Even compared to first class, it's impressive. Velvet drapery hangs from the windows. Resting on thick Persian carpet are two armchairs, a small desk, and several crammed bookshelves. Mostly concealed behind a screen is a large four-poster bed. A tall steamer trunk stands upright in one corner. Mounted on the walls is a dizzying collection of oil paintings and all sorts of native handiwork. A pipe with a beaded stem, a decorated goose head, some kind of tool with a wickedly sharp triangular blade.
"Where's your bloody ringmaster?" shouts Brogan from the corridor. "Someone who isn't a freak!"
Will turns to Mr. Dorian in alarm. The ringmaster seems untroubled.
"You can see the mayor if you like,"
the cavernous voice of Mr. Beaupré replies.
"You address him as your lordship."
There's a sober pause before Brogan replies.
"Fine. You just get me to him."
"Christian, go show our guest in, please," says Mr. Dorian.
Then he swings open the lid of the steamer trunk and nods for Will to step inside. Will does as he's told, and the lid swiftly closes and latches, leaving him in total darkness. He can, however, hear everything.
"You the man in charge?" demands Brogan.
"That would be me, sir. Mr. Dorian at your service."
He speaks with a quiet elegance that carries a weight of authority.
"I don't believe we've been properly introduced."
"Name's Brinley. I'm Ed Brakeman."
So he has changed his name, Will thinks from inside the trunk.
"There's a boy hop the train. You seen him?"
From outside the door, Mr. Beaupré bellows,
"Is he addressing you as your lordship?"
"It's quite all right, Mr. Beaupré. Thank you," replies Mr. Dorian. "Now, Mr. Brinley, we've barely woken, but no, I have not seen any such youngster. I will, however, tell my people to keep an eye open."
"You all look pretty awake to me," Brogan says unpleasantly. "And I can smell him. I know he's around here somewhere."
"With respect, sir," says Mr. Dorian, "are you certain the odor does not originate from you?"
"Only 'cause he splashed me with it when I was trying to catch him."
Mr. Dorian makes an understanding sound.
"It is a powerful smell."
"It is a very, very bad smell,"
rumbles Mr. Beaupré from the corridor.
"Well," says Brogan, "I'm sure you won't mind if I take a little look around."
It does not sound like a question.
"I must kindly ask you to leave our carriages," Mr. Dorian tells him. "These are the private property of Circus Dante, and you have, alas, not been invited to enter."
Brogan scoffs.
"Don't take that tone with me. You're connected to the Boundless, and you need our engine and our brakeman, and you follow our rules or there'll be hell to pay. If it turns out you've been harboring this hooligan, we'll shunt the whole lot of you at the next sighting, and you can give your show to the mosquitoes.
I hardly think you have the authority to do such a thing, Mr. Dorian replies calmly.
You'd be surprised. And I don't take my orders from circus folk, especially half-breeds like you.
How perceptive you are, Mr. Dorian says placidly. I prefer the term Métis, however.
Inside the trunk, Will is amazed at the ringmaster's restraint. Having grown up in Winnipeg, Will is familiar with the Métis, the offspring of French settlers and Cree Indians, and the insults they endured, especially after their failed uprising. Will hears Brogan moving about the carriage, shifting things. He's coming closer to the trunk and laughs.
This would be a daft place for someone to hide, wouldn't it?
Horrified, Will hears Mr. Dorian say,
Be my guest.
Will nearly chokes. Involuntarily, he takes a step back, but there's nothing to conceal him. No heavy furs, no garments at all. He hears the clasp open. Swiftly, the lid swings wide, and Brogan stands before him with his busted nose staring directly into his eyes. There's not 2 feet between them. Mutely, Will stares back. Brogan's blue eyes dart about quickly, then his mouth compresses in sour frustration. Turning his back, he slams the lid shut. Only now does Will's heart pound, with equal measure terror and wonder at his escape.
If you're quite done now, Mr. Brinley, comes Mr. Dorian's voice, I'll have one of my men escort you out.
I don't need no escort. You remember what I said. We want that boy. The Mounties want to question him.
Intriguing, says Mr. Dorian.
For murder. You find him. You tell me you're my men. We'll be keeping an eye on your cars. You can count on that.
Thank you, Mr. Brinley. Mr. Beaupré, please show our uninvited guest to the nearest door.
Shall I throw him off the train?
Will hears the giant say.
No, Mr. Beaupré, that won't be necessary.
Will hears a heavy sigh of disappointment from the giant, then the sound of Brogan's retreating footsteps. The stateroom door closes. After a few more moments, the lid to the trunk opens, and Mr. Dorian smiles at him.
You can come out now, lad.
How? Will asks, turning to look back inside the trunk. Why didn't he see me? Mr. Dorian steps nimbly inside.
Close it,
he tells Will, who does so. From inside, he says,
Now open it.
Will opens the lid to behold an empty trunk.
Where are you?
He asks in awe.
Reach out your hand.
Will stretches his hand out into the emptiness and gasps when he touches an invisible shoulder. Mr. Dorian steps into full view.
It's a very simple trick. Mirrors spring into place when the lid opens and show you a reflection of the inside of the trunk. You think you're seeing the back. It's hardly foolproof. You need but reach inside. But people are easily fooled by their eyes.
Thank you for hiding me.
You don't look like a murderer to me, young Mr. Everett. Nor did you when I first met you 3 years ago.
I didn't know if you'd remember me. Your lordship,
Will adds hastily. Mr. Dorian chuckles.
You needn't bother with that. And certainly I remember you. It was an eventful day, especially for you by all accounts.
After the avalanche, Will didn't see Mr. Dorian again. The company train made many trips back and forth between Farewell, carrying the injured out, bringing back supplies for the men waiting their turn for transportation off the mountain. It was 2 days before Will and his father got back to town. By then, Marin and the Clack Brothers Circus was gone, and Will's life had changed forever.
And now you've been accused of murder by this Mr. Brinley.
His real name's Brogan. He was up in the mountains, too. He tried to steal the golden spike.
Good stories seem to have a habit of finding you, William.
I've never thought of it like that,
Will says.
I always thought, well, I was just there when they happened to other people.
Mr. Dorian smiles.
Well, I'd like to hear this particular story from the beginning, but first...
I'm sure he'd like a bath,
says a voice behind Will.
He turns to see Marin standing in the doorway in a simple green dress. Without her makeup or vibrant clothing, she looks younger, much more like the girl he met 3 years ago. He can't help smiling. Like he's just found something important that's been lost a very long time.
"I was looking for you," he blurts out. "In the junction. I was really hoping..."
All the words fly out of his head, and his face reddens, babbling like a little kid. He wishes he'd kept his mouth shut. He realizes how bad he must smell and how generally shabby he looks. He glances down at his tattered socks, wondering how long she's been there.
"I guess I have a habit of just showing up," she says.
"Did you know, William," says Mr. Dorian, "that it's because of you that Marin is now part of our show?"
"Really?"
"On that train into the mountains, you told me how fine the Clack's wire walker was. I made inquiries, and indeed, you were right. And here we all are. No doubt you'd like the chance to bathe. Marin, can you please show him to the washroom? And on the way, pick out some clean clothes for him in the wardrobe car. He'll need to launder his own."
"I'd just like to apologize for the Sasquatch urine,"
Will says, and sees Marin bite back laughter.
"Come with me," she says.
He hangs well back as she leads him down the corridor.
"It doesn't help, you know," she says over her shoulder. "I can still smell you."
"I can't smell it anymore," Will admits.
"It's not so bad. After a day with the animals, Christian smells even worse."
You know him?"
Will asks with a pang of jealousy.
"He's my brother."
"Oh."
He falls silent a moment. Over the years, he's often had conversations with her in his head. Now he struggles to find a place to start. She beats him to it.
"You never came to the circus," she says.
It takes him a moment to understand what she means.
"Oh, I really wanted to, but... well, there was an avalanche, and you were gone by the time I got back down."
"You're all rich now,"
Will laughs.
"I hardly look rich."
She regards him carefully.
"You talk differently, too."
"I suppose so. I don't use ain't as much. I miss ain't."
"Are you still drawing?"
He smiles.
"Yes."
"Do you have any with you?"
"Just a sketchbook."
"You'll show me later?"
She seems touchingly excited.
"If you like. Have you crossed Niagara Falls yet?"
She shakes her head.
"Not yet, but one day, absolutely."
"You've mastered the disappearing act."
"Thank you. It went pretty well the other night, I thought."
"Did Mr. Dorian hire you right away?"
"No. I stayed with the Clacks for another year almost. My whole family did. But then my pa had an accident and broke his leg in two places. The Clacks didn't want him like that, so we all left. It was a bad show anyway. I wrote to Mr. Dorian, and at first he said he wanted only a wire walker, but he agreed to take on my brothers if I signed a 5-year contract."
She leads him into another car, which is entirely filled with long racks of costumes and steamer trunks, spilling over with gloves and scarves and bracelets. Skinny paths run through the rolling hills of fabric and color. Marin casts a critical eye over him and then begins sifting through the piles.
"Here, these should fit."
Will takes them.
"These are clown clothes."
"Clown's assistant, actually."
Just by looking at the denim overalls, Will can see that the legs are too short. The white shirt has puffy sleeves and ruffled cuffs.
"You look like a pirate,"
she promises with mischief in her eyes.
"You never wanted to be a pirate?"
Will doesn't tell her he used to dream about it all the time.
"How about that other normal shirt there?"
he asks, pointing. She shrugs.
"If you must. You need shoes, too."
She rummages through a box on the floor and extracts a pair of fat, white shoes that are twice as big as Will's feet.
"Here."
Will looks at them in mute dismay.
"These are definitely clown shoes."
Marin begins laughing, a surprisingly hearty sound to come out of such a slim person.
"I suppose there's these,"
she says, pulling out a pair of ordinary black shoes. Will takes them, gratefully. From another mound of clothing, she picks out some socks and underwear without a hint of awkwardness. Will is embarrassed and turns so she won't see him blushing.
"And this, too," she says, and when he looks over, she's holding out his Sasquatch tooth. He takes it from her. It's warm, like it's been in her pocket a long time. Thanks.
I stole it, kind of.
His eyes widen.
I thought you just forgot.
She clears her throat.
No, I wanted to show you how clever I was. I was going to give it back when you came to the circus. Sorry I've had it so long.
He smiles.
That's all right.
He likes the idea of her having it. He wonders, has she been keeping it in her pocket all these years? Did she ever think of me sometimes?
Come on,
she says, leading him to a door at the end of the car.
This is the men's washroom.
Strings crisscross the room, draped with all manner of clothing. The single window has been soaped so no one can see in. There are a couple of big circular metal tubs. Through a drain in the middle of the floor, Will sees the dark flash of passing rail ties. Marin walks to a cistern bolted to the wall. Attached to the spigot is a length of rubber hosing. She picks up the end and turns a tap, and a gush of water pounds against the bottom of one of the tin tubs. After mere seconds, she turns the water off.
That's all?
Will asks.
That's what you get. The water's gotta last a long time.
Is it hot?
She shakes her head.
It's very, very cold. You can wash your clothes in the tub after you've bathed.
Bathed seems a very fancy word for what takes place here. Even when they lived in that cold water flat in Winnipeg, he had hot water when he bathed, which was seldom. Marin closes the door behind her. Will is dismayed that there's no lock. He looks at the thin layer of water in the tub, which itself seems none too clean, and strips off his torn, reeking clothes. He begins to fold them, and realizes it's pointless. He steps quickly into the tub. The chilly water scarcely reaches his ankles. On the tub's rim is a mottled lump that he assumes must be soap. He crouches and dips it into the water, wondering how many people have used this soap and this tub. The door flies open and Will looks over in horror. A burly man strides in with hardly a glance at him.
I'm having a bath, says Will.
I can see that, says the fellow in a thick Scottish burr. Giddy on!
But, isn't it my turn?
Will asks and feels immediately childish.
Lad, how many tubs you see in here?
Two,
he sighs.
That's right.
The man takes the hose and fills the second tub, strips, and hops into the cold water with great satisfaction.
Ah, that's a treat, that is. Haven't bathed since I don't know when.
He lathers himself up.
Nothing like a good invigorating wash and scrub.
He stops to sniff in Will's direction.
I think you might scrub a little harder.
Will sighs.
Yes, it's just some Sasquatch urine.
Nasty stuff,
the fellow remarks. Will tries to wash himself as thoroughly and quickly as possible. He keeps glancing back at the door, terrified it will burst open again, and a troop of gymnasts will somersault in. Maybe the giant, too. He remembers the sandpaper rub of soap from childhood, and finds it strangely comforting. The water turns an unappetizing shade of gray. He steps out and looks around for a towel. Hanging from a nail is a piece of something so threadbare and stained, Will can only imagine it has been there for the last 20 years. It's dry, at least. Gingerly, he pats himself fast all over. He dresses in his new circus clothes. From his soiled jacket, he carefully removes his watch, his sketchbook and pencil, his muskeg spectacles, money, his Sasquatch tooth, and the funeral car key. He swallows and covers the key with his sketchbook. He glances at the Scottish bather, but he's taking no interest. Will dumps the whole lot of his soiled clothing into the tub. He pummels them with the bar of soap, then twists them dry and hangs them from an open stretch of clothesline. He's probably ruined the jacket. For a moment, he feels heartsick, thinking of his father on the same train but miles away, probably with no clue what's happened to Will. And if he did know, what could he do? Would he stop the entire train and search it front to back? Would he rescue him? Will frowns as he suddenly realizes that he doesn't want his father to rescue him. When he opens the washroom door, he finds Marin talking to Mr. Dorian.
Did you enjoy your bath?
She asks, a smile pulling at the corners of her mouth.
Very much, thank you. It's always nice to have some company.
Would you care for some breakfast, William?
Mr. Dorian asks.
Breakfast? He looks at his watch.
Just past 6 o'clock. From somewhere comes the smell of bacon, and his stomach gives a long, noisy gulp.
I heard that, says Marin. I'll take you to the dining tent.
Tent?
We call it the tent even though we're on the train. Habit.
I'll join you shortly, says Mr. Dorian.
Will follows Marin through several cars. There are humbler berths here, and long communal wash basins where men shave in their suspenders or splash water on their faces. The air is muggy with colognes and perfumes. People are hoisting up trousers, fastening belts, combing hair, pulling on stockings, squeezing past one another in the narrow corridor, too early yet to grunt more than a hello. A whole village of people getting ready for their day.
It's very cozy, he says.
She nods.
Home away from home.
The first thing Will sees passing into the next car is a man and a woman on what looks like a giant tandem bicycle, pedaling hard. The bicycle isn't going anywhere because the whirling wheels don't touch the floor. Thick cables sprout from them and disappear into the ceiling.
What are they doing?
Will whispers as he and Marin walk by.
Making electricity for the cars, she replies. Everyone does 20-minute shifts during the day.
That's incredible,
he says.
And you thought only first class had electrics.
She opens a door, and Will is nearly bowled over with the sound of hundreds of people talking, laughing, bawling out to pass the eggs or fetch the coffee. Long trestle tables run the length of the car, leaving narrow aisles that are crammed with people carrying platters, heaving with pancakes and roasted potatoes, and rashers of bacon and cornmeal muffins and baked beans and pitchers of milk. Will isn't sure he's ever seen so many people seated in one space. As soon as one person leaves, another slips into his seat, and the eating begins again. Will tries not to stare, but he can't help noticing all sorts of people, the likes of which he's never seen. Mr. Beaupré, of course, is impossible to miss, given his immense size.
I wanted to throw him off the train,
Will overhears him saying to the fellow next to him.
But they said no!
Across from the giant is a pair of slim Asian gentlemen who appear to be joined together at the hip. A large woman mops her beard daintily with a napkin, and then Will absolutely does stare because running across the top of a table carrying a small stack of dirty dishes is a gray monkey. White fur grows around his face, making him look like a solemn waiter with mutton chop sideburns. And he's not the only one. Across all the tables now, Will sees more monkeys hustling about, bringing people cups and pots of tea. Dazed, he says to Marin,
"There are monkeys.
Japanese macaques. They're very helpful."
She takes his hand matter-of-factly and leads him through the crush to a smaller table with a linen tablecloth and a small vase of flowers in the center. When she releases his hand, he looks at it, like it might be transformed. A girl has never taken his hand before.
Help yourself,
she says, nodding at the platters of food. Will takes a clean plate and piles it until there is no room left. He's never been so hungry. Where to start? In the end, he pours maple syrup over his stack of pancakes and carves himself an enormous wedge. But before he can cram it into his mouth, a monkey taps him on the arm. Will looks down and sees a macaque expectantly holding out a steaming towel.
To wash your hands,
Marin says with a grin.
Oh, says Will, taking it. Thank you.
He washes his hands and then digs in. 15 minutes later, he's finishing off the last strips of bacon and bits of fried potatoes. As if from nowhere, Mr. Dorian sits down opposite him.
Well, William Everett, it seems as if you've replenished yourself. Are you in a talkative mood?
A monkey comes and takes Will's plate and cutlery away. Will holds on to his glass of milk. He takes a drink and then launches into his story. He can't explain it, but he trusts Mr. Dorian, and he leaves nothing out. It's a long story, and Will isn't sure he's ever talked so much all at once. but it passes quickly, and he realizes he rather likes telling it. He likes seeing how they listen. More than that, how they sometimes seem captivated. And he wonders now if he isn't as bad at talking to people as he thought.
"That is quite a tale," Mr. Dorian says. "You're a man of hidden talents."
Will feels his face warm and knows he's blushing.
"Jumping those trains at night is no mean feat."
"I think you would have killed me otherwise," Will replies.
"Quite likely," Mr. Dorian says. "You're the only witness to a murder. If he's killed one man, he can kill two."
Will's breakfast suddenly feels unpleasantly heavy in his stomach.
"He wants the key," says Will,
remembering how Brogan's eyes locked onto it, how he offered to spare his life if only Will gave up the key.
Marin nods.
Will keeps looking over at her, even though she's not talking much. He likes looking at her.
"May I see it?"
Mr. Dorian asks. Will takes it from his pocket and hands it to the ringmaster, who peers at it carefully, both sides, before returning it.
"The last spike's in there,"
Will whispers.
"The one made of gold?"
"Is it?"
Will wonders if he's made a mistake, but he wants to impress Marin, and he'd like someone to tell him what to do now.
"We may be getting another visit from Mr. Brogan," says Mr. Dorian, "and he probably won't be alone this time."
"There's Mackie," Will says. "He's in on it."
"And possibly more. Right at this moment, there are brakemen sauntering about overhead, watching the couplings between our carriages."
"There are?"
Will says.
"They suspect you're here, and they expect you to bolt."
"There's a Mountie on the train,"
Will says.
"Samuel Steele."
"Alas, we are a little island unto ourselves back here," says Mr. Dorian. "There are miles of freight cars between us and colonist class, and we're not scheduled to stop until late afternoon."
"How about the pigeons?" Marin asks. "We could send a message forward."
"They're swift, but not swift enough to outpace the Boundless at 40 miles an hour."
"Can I stay here until the next stop?"
Will asks.
"Of course," says Mr. Dorian with a kind smile. "But I don't think your problems will end there. They'll be watching for you. If Brogan's as intent on this key as we think, I don't think you'd make it very far without being caught."
"He could if he joins the circus," Marin says.
Will thinks she's joking, until he sees Mr. Dorian nod.
"I see exactly what you mean," the ringmaster says, turning to Will. "We have an agreement with the Boundless to give a number of performances during the journey. You saw the first the other night. When the train stops this afternoon, we're to walk up to colonist class for our second show. Then we're to remain on the passenger cars and make a performance in every class. The finale is in first class on our last night of the journey."
"You can be part of our show,"
Marin says. Will frowns.
"But if Brogan's watching, he'll recognize me."
"You'll be disguised," Marin says. "Obviously."
"Completely unrecognizable,"
adds Mr. Dorian.
"Madame Lemoyne is one of the finest makeup artists in the world."
Will's eyes have fallen to the tablecloth, his fingers tracing part of the pattern in the embroidery.
"But I can't do anything."
Mr. Dorian waves his hand.
"Nonsense. Everyone can do something."
"Not that Winston lad,"
Marin remarks. Mr. Dorian purses his lips.
"Well, no. He was completely hopeless, but we still worked him into the show."
"What did he do?"
Will asks.
"We cut him in half every night."
"Twice on Sundays,"
adds Marin.
"Until the accident," says Mr. Dorian, wincing.
Will stops breathing.
"You didn't really..."
"Heavens, no," says Mr. Dorian with a rare chuckle. He looks at Marin.
"He thought we actually sawed him in half. No, no, he was trampled by the camels."
"It's true,"
Marin says soberly. Mr. Dorian takes a drink of his coffee.
"I can already tell that you, Mr. Everett, have many talents. What do you say? I think it's the safest way to get you up to the passenger cars."
"And you'll both be going?"
Will wants to make sure.
"Absolutely. It will be the three of us."
He likes the idea, as much as it makes him nervous. Mr. Dorian seems to have more faith in his abilities than he does. He hopes he doesn't disappoint him. Or Marin.
"Yes," he says. I'll do it.
Excellent. Marin, why don't you take Will to the rehearsal hall and see what grabs his fancy? Take care crossing between cars. Make sure there's no brakeman looking about. I'll go find Madame Lemoyne and let her know what we have in mind.
I never thought I'd run away to the circus,
Will says.
Isn't it every boy's dream? Marin asks.
Mr. Dorian gets up to leave, and then as an afterthought, leans closer to Will.
I'd not tell anyone about the key you carry. For your own safety, you understand.
This ain't the way it was supposed to go, Mackie says nervously.
No point whining about it,
Brogan snaps and takes a snort of whiskey. He's battered his share of men, but this is the first he's killed, and he wants to burn away the memory of the guard's face.
Damn fool got all high and mighty. Started hollering.
He shakes his head bitterly.
Could have had a share.
The brakeman's cabin shudders over a rough patch of track. There isn't much by way of suspension. Spaced every 40 freight cars, they are tiny shacks on wheels meant to sleep two men. The place smells like creosote, food that was best eaten a week ago, and man stink. A couple of hammocks crisscross the room. There's a small stove, a table, a hole in the planks for doing your business, and so many pegs and hooks jutting from the walls that it's a danger to lean anywhere. It makes the caboose look like first class. Right now, Brogan's cabin is crammed with the 8 other brakemen he chose for his job. At some time or another, he's worked with all of them. He might not exactly trust them, but he's got dirt on each and every one, and that wins a man's loyalty. Anyway, he's relying on their greed to keep them in line. And, on this job, there's a lot to be greedy about.
What do we do now?
Chisholm asks. He's got buggy eyes that make Brogan think of boiled eggs. Brogan looks around at the weathered faces of his other men. Peck, Richter, Strawn, Delaware, Talbot, Welch, and knows they're all tense and waiting for him to lead.
Nothing happens without that key, he says, laying it out. The boy has the key, and the boy's in those circus cars. That half-breed ringmaster's hiding him. We get the key, we're back in business.
You sure he didn't just fall off?
Mackie asks.
Hard to believe a kid could make it across all those cars at night.
His father was a brakeman, Brogan says, and a damn fine one. I saw that boy up in the mountains. Survived an avalanche. He's got grit. If the kid fell, it was into the elephant cage.
If he's alive, he's blabbed by now, says Welch.
Don't matter if he has, says Brogan. Who's he gonna tell? You think anyone's gonna take the word of some circus freak? Anyway, if he's in those cars, he ain't leaving them alive.
There's a brief, heavy silence.
You sure you want to be killing the son of the general manager?
Chisholm asks, looking around at the other men anxiously.
Can you think of a better way to keep someone quiet? Brogan demands fiercely. You boys can step off at any time. When the stakes are this high, you're gonna have to dirty your hands some. This job is once in a lifetime, and you'll have more money than you can spend during it. Or would you all rather keep working the rails? Peck, you lose any more fingers, you're no good for even the mail car. And Richter, remember what happened to your buddy McGovern? Who's gonna take care of your family if your legs get sliced off during a flying switch? No one will sell us insurance, boys. We got nothing. We're slaves. This is our chance to bust free.
He watches his men and knows he has them.
We're going back to the circus, all of us this time, he says, and we're gonna take that boy.
Chapter 8. Joining the Circus. Zirkus Dante's practice room is a long, narrow gymnasium, filling an entire double-decker train carriage. Light pours in from the windows and skylights, all of which have been covered with rice paper to keep spectators from gawking inside when the train is at rest. Colorful handbills plaster the walls, advertising wild animals, death-defying feats, and miraculous marvels. 2 stilt walkers waltz across the room, and Will realizes they're the Siamese twins he saw earlier in the dining car. Both men are perched atop three stilts and work together so seamlessly that Will can only stare in wonder.
"Those are the Chung brothers," Marin tells him. "They're one of our most popular acts."
"They're incredible."
"It's too bad they don't get along better."
"No?"
"They hate each other. Well, who wouldn't, being attached to someone their whole life? Lee actually tried to stab Meng once. Luckily, his sight's terrible. He needs Meng to see."
Farther down the room, an acrobat flings himself from his trapeze, tumbles through the air, and lands on a seesaw that launches a second acrobat up to a high set of rings. Both men are lean and muscular. Their heads are bald, except for a tuft of long hair at the back, which is gathered into three braids.
"Are they..."
Will begins.
"Mohawks, yes," says Marin. "The best acrobats I've ever seen. Heights mean nothing to them. They're fearless."
Across the carriage, against a mirrored stretch of wall, a trio of leggy, milk-haired ballerinas is limbering up.
"Mr. Dorian thinks ballet lends the circus an air of distinction," Marin says, catching Will looking at the dancers. "Don't fall in love with them. They're not quite as angelic as they look."
"Really?"
Will asks, intrigued.
"You should hear them cuss."
Elsewhere, a few performers are practicing a complicated three-way juggling routine. Will feels like he's part of something rare and exciting, but all the activity in the room is a bit overwhelming, and he can't imagine what he might be able to do.
"Look," Marin says, "don't worry. No one expects you to do anything like this. It would just be good if you had some little thing you could do during the show."
"And if nothing works out, you can just saw me in half," he says.
"Exactly. Maybe you can help me with my tightrope act."
She leads him over to a long stretch of wire suspended a couple of feet off the floor. Even if he slips, he doesn't have far to fall. Marin disappears behind a curtain and comes out in a leotard. She is very slim, but her legs look strong.
"Here," she says, handing Will a small cloth sack. "There's some things in there I'll ask for later."
After some stretches, she takes up a long balancing pole and steps onto the wire. She walks across a few times effortlessly, then does a somersault. A small furrow appears in her forehead as she reclines on the wire. Her lips compress on one side and then the other. She lets go of the balancing pole and does a backward somersault. Then she lies flat again and uses her feet to push her head first along the narrow wire. Will can only marvel at her skill.
"All right," she says, still balancing on her back. "Throw those four balls my way, fast."
Will takes them from the sack and fires them at her. One bounces off her knee. Another sails beyond her reach.
"I meant throw them in the general direction of my hands," she says, laughing.
He runs around, gathering up the balls and trying not to get crushed by the Chung brothers on their stilts.
"Get out of our way, little bug!"
Lee shouts down at him. When Will throws the balls a second time, Marin catches them all and instantly juggles them.
"That's amazing!" Will cries.
After another few seconds, she tosses back the balls and says,
"Now the padlock."
He finds it in the bag and tosses the heavy piece of metal to her. After catching it in one hand, she cajoles some tools from her sleeve, inserts them into the lock, and teases until it springs open.
"I can't believe it,"
Will exclaims.
"It's still taking too long," she says. "Again, please."
They run through the padlock bit once more, and she's faster this time. Will chews his lip.
"I don't feel like I'm doing very much."
"It would be great if you could get up on the wire with me,"
she says, hopping down to push a stepladder closer.
"Take off your shoes and give it a try."
He strips his feet bare and climbs the ladder.
"Step on with just one foot," she instructs him. "Make sure the wire's centered, right between your big toe and second toe. That's it. Now arms out, looking dead ahead. Keep your balance."
He loses his balance immediately and jumps clumsily to the floor.
"That's okay," she says. "Everyone's liked it at first. Again."
He tries again and again and again. He feels like an idiot windmilling his arms around, bucking back and forth.
"I don't think I have the knack," he says.
She doesn't disagree with him.
"Maybe I can help. Come back up.
Once more he steps onto the wire, and this time she's right behind him. She puts her hands firmly on his waist. His breath catches, and for a second, all he thinks about is the pressure of her fingers against him.
"You're doing it," she says.
Immediately, he's thinking about his balance again and starts wavering. His arms tilt wildly, but Marin's hands nudge him from side to side, guiding him. He stays on the wire.
"I don't like you're doing it for me," he says.
"I'm just helping you."
"Let me try it alone."
She nudges him to one side.
"You're not ready yet. Focus now."
He tries to take a step away from her and immediately topples off.
"Suit yourself," she says, exasperated. "Go try something else if you want."
She goes back to her practicing. He wonders if he's hurt her feelings. He didn't mean to be rude. He just felt ridiculous, flapping around like a baby bird. He doesn't want people doing things for him, especially not her. He looks around the gymnasium. What can he do? He sees a short pair of practice stilts leaning against the wall. Even though they put him only inches off the floor, it takes him a long time just to stand upright for 2 seconds. He takes one step and then topples onto the sawdust floor. He picks himself up and tries again, and this time manages 3 careening steps before sprawling flat again. It's easier than tightrope walking, but just. Across the rehearsal car, a clown is watching him. White face, huge painted mouth, eyeliner, a curly wig, a red ball for a nose. He's just standing there, dejectedly, arms hanging long by his sides. Then, as if every bone has suddenly dissolved, he collapses onto the floor and is nothing but a large puddle of puffy clothing. When he springs back up, fully formed again, Will smiles. The clown crooks a finger at him. Will puts down the stilts and walks over. The clown's mouth widens in silent glee. They regard each other. The clown pats Will's cheek gently with both hands. Will chuckles a little awkwardly. The clown pulls a pickle out of Will's ear, then puts both hands on his hips and tilts his head back in silent, raucous laughter.
"It's not that funny," Will says.
The clown stops and assumes such a tragic expression that Will can't help but laugh.
"All right, you're funny."
Eyes wide, his grin wider, the clown takes Will by the shoulders and guides him back against a wall. He pats Will's head and motions for him to stay put.
"Okay," Will says.
The clown walks away, stopping every few steps to look back over his shoulder and make sure Will's still there. Will has to laugh. When he's a good 20 paces away, the clown stops, turns, and gives a big smile. Then he pats his hands in the air.
"You want me to stay here?" Will asks.
The clown clenches his fists and makes his body rigid.
"You want me to stay very still?"
The clown gives a hop of joy.
"Okay,"
says Will. The clown turns his back on him. In one swift movement, he ties a scarf over his eyes. He bends down and opens a slim case. He draws out 3 knives. He hurls one back over his shoulder. Before Will can say a word, a knife impales itself in the wood next to his neck. Will dares not swallow. He dares not even blink. The clown proceeds to hurl another knife backward at Will. The blade streaks toward him and thunks into the wood over his head. Before he can breathe, a third knife buries its tip on the other side of his neck, so close he can feel the cold steel. The clown turns around with the biggest smile of all and jumps up and down with jubilation. Everyone has stopped what they're doing and now gives a rousing round of applause, except Marin, who strides over to the clown and smacks him on the shoulder.
"Roal!"
she cries.
"That was cruel!"
Will gingerly steps away from the wall, afraid of leaving some part of himself behind.
"I rarely miss,"
the clown insists, speaking for the first time. He has a slight accent.
"You terrified him!"
"I'm fine,"
says Will, and strangely he is. He feels oddly immortal. He's survived a murderer and a Sasquatch. Nothing can touch him.
"You're a clown and a knife thrower."
"And my brother, sadly,"
says Marin.
"How's the little baby girl?"
Roel asks, grasping her tightly by the shoulders. She expertly twists to escape his grip.
"Ho-ho, very good."
His gaze turns on Will. "Is this the criminal?"
"My name's Will.
I'm not a criminal.
I heard you were a murderer.
No, I deny it too.
Well, criminal or no, I'm happy to meet you.
He extends his hand, and when Will grips it, it collapses like a rotten peach. With a gasp, Will looks down to see the fake hand that Roel holds from inside his sleeve.
That is so childish, Marin tells her brother.
Many children come to the circus, he retorts. He peels off his wig and red nose. He has hair the same color as his sister's.
How did you do the knife trick?
Will asks.
With a great deal of practice, Roel says.
And the help of a mirror, Marin adds, pointing.
Look. For the first time, Will notices the small mirror attached to the wall in front of where Roel stands.
Still, Will says, you did it all backward.
Yes, I confess I'm a bit out of practice, but it went well.
Will decides not to think about this.
So we are harboring a murderer,
Roel says, swiping off his face paint with a rag.
He's not a murderer, and he's coming with me and Mr. Dorian to perform on the train. We need to work him into the show.
Roel chews his lip.
I'm not sure he's very coordinated.
He's not.
Hey,
objects Will.
Can you teach him some tricks?
Marin asks her brother.
How long do I have?
6 hours.
I don't think so. Do you have any skills, Will?
Not really,
he says.
Yes, you do,
Marin says, as if remembering suddenly.
You can draw. Show him.
Reluctantly, he pulls the sketchbook from his pocket. She takes it from his hands, in the same familiar way as she did 3 years ago. It bothered him then. Now he likes it. It's as if they're old friends.
Look at these.
This one's of you,
Roel tells her with a grin. Will's face heats up.
Just look how good they all are,
Marin says quickly, flipping pages. Will sees the color rise in her cheeks, too.
Yes, says Roel with a shrug. This is very pleasant, but... Well, can you do one of me?
I'll try, says Will.
Roel picks up a knife and holds it back over his head, ready to throw.
Like this!
Will locks onto him with his eyes and does a quick gesture drawing. It makes him nervous with Marin watching him.
Roel, come see,
she says when Will is done.
Is that me?
He asks.
Of course it's you, says Marin impatiently.
Roel looks at Will for corroboration. Will nods.
But my hair doesn't look like that.
It's a sketch, Will says, just to capture your movement.
A smile spreads across Roel's handsome face.
I look massive, like a giant about to throw a boulder. I would like this picture. May I?
Without waiting for an answer, he rips the page out.
Roel,
says Marin,
you can't just rip a page out of an artist's sketchbook.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you should have it, says Will.
Look at this,
Roel says to the other performers, holding the drawing up in the air, grinning. Before Will knows it, a small crowd has gathered around him.
Could you do one of me?
Asks the prettiest of the ballerinas, batting her eyelashes.
I would like one as well,
says Mung from his stilts.
I'm the eldest. I should be first,
Lee says.
You're practically blind,
Mung replies.
It would give you no enjoyment. I will bite you, little brother.
I'd love to do all of you,
Will says hurriedly to the crowd.
I want a proper portrait,
demands a portly woman in a riding outfit pushing to the front.
Not these little scribbles. Can you do that for me?
I'm not sure, ma'am.
You call me Duchess Sabore,
she says.
My family is royalty in Luxembourg. You must do a portrait in oils, in the finest style of the old masters. For this, I will pay you $100. You will start after lunch.
With this, the Duchess walks off to the muffled laughter of the other performers.
She doesn't have $100,
Marin tells him.
Do I still have to do it?
He's fine with drawings, but has never been happy with proper portraits. The people always come out wrong. Marin shakes her head.
She once offered someone $1,000 for their hair. Don't worry. She'll have forgotten the whole thing before lunch. Still, you could turn a good business with this. Maybe Mr. Dorian would let you have a sideshow. We could dress you up and... That's it!
What?
Asks Will. Your act, says Mr. Dorian. In surprise, Will turns to see the ringmaster standing behind him.
People love having their portraits done,
Marin says.
These aren't proper portraits, Will says, alarmed.
And it's not a circus act, Roll says.
It is if he does them blindfolded,
Marin says, taking the scarf from around her brother's neck. Mr. Dorian nods.
Intriguing.
Blindfolded?
Says Will with mounting panic. She ties the scarf tightly around his face, and to Will's amazement, he can see right through it, almost as if nothing obscures his eyes.
How does it work?
He asks, unwinding it and peering at it up close.
Tie it one way and you can see through. The other way...
She holds it against his face, and it's as if the room has been blacked out.
If someone in the audience is suspicious, we tie it on them this way, and then we wrap it on you the other way. But you'll also have your back to them. You'll never set eyes on them.
I can't do that, he protests.
Of course you can, because I'll be standing in front of you with a small mirror attached to my dress. You'll see the person. You'll draw them. They'll walk away with a lovely picture, and everyone's happy.
Mr. Dorian grins at her.
You'll be ringmistress of your own show one day, and here's Madame Lemoine to help us with your disguise.
A short, tent-shaped woman walks dolefully across the room.
We need to transform William into an Indian lad, I think,
Mr. Dorian tells her. Madame Lemoine glances at Will, lifts her fleshy hands, and sighs.
Excellent, says Mr. Dorian.
Madame Lemoine shrugs and walks away.
What just happened?
Will asks Marin.
We're supposed to go with her. She's not a big talker, Madame Lemoine.
Will and Marin follow her to the next car and into a room cluttered with wigs and colorful jars and brushes and mustaches and noses and other little bits of people. Stools are set up in front of a long mirror. Madame Lemoine motions Will to a chair before a stained metal sink.
Hair first,
she says, sounding incredibly depressed. She wraps a ratty piece of burlap around his shoulders and pushes his head back. She soaks his short hair, then slides on gloves. She opens a jar containing some foul-smelling black goo.
What's in it?
Will asks, recoiling.
Never you mind.
Without further ado, she starts slapping it on. She's none too gentle. Her meaty fingers poke and shove at his face. He looks at Marin, who smiles encouragingly.
Eyebrows, too,
says Madame Lemoine, handing Marin the jar.
Close your eyes,
Marin tells Will. She is much gentler. He concentrates on her fingertips, stroking his eyebrows. It feels a bit tickly, but surprisingly nice, especially now that Madame Lemoine has stopped smacking his head around. When Marin's done, she daubs carefully around his eyebrows with a moist cloth to clean away the dye.
You can open your eyes now,
she tells him. Sitting up, he asks,
how long do I have to leave it in for?
An hour.
When Will first glimpses himself in the mirror, he gasps. His eyebrows and slick hair are startlingly black against his pale face.
It doesn't look right,
he murmurs.
Wait until the face,
says Madame Lemoine.
Don't touch. Go and come back. I prepare paint now.
Marin leads him out of the compartment.
I feel like a freak, he says.
That's not a word we use around here,
she tells him.
Oh, sorry.
We call them marvels. That's nicer, don't you think?
Will nods.
Much nicer.
Speaking of marvels,
she trails off as if reconsidering.
Outsiders aren't supposed to go in there, but you're practically one of us now.
Will smiles to himself. What would it really be like to be part of Circus Dante? What a huge and very odd family it is.
You'll like this, I bet,
she says.
Come on.
Will follows her, swept up by her enthusiasm. Across another set of couplings to the next car, she opens the door and ushers him inside. Black blinds cover the windows. From the ceiling hangs a single pale oil lamp. The room is like a shadowy museum, all the tables and display cases shrouded with curtains and cloths. Cabinets and steamer trunks are everywhere, some open and revealing lurid masks or a collection of bones. Down the carriage, a dozen life-size marionettes sway from hooks in the ceiling, jerking as the train rattles over a rough section of track. Will hesitates at the sight of a narrow table with a body atop it, covered by a sheet. From the bottom protrudes a pair of large, yellowed feet. A nearby workbench glints with sharp metal instruments. The body gives a sudden tortured gasp, its skeletal ribs pressing against the sheet.
"Who is that?"
Will says, jerking back.
"Dying Zouave,"
Marin says, placing a cool hand on his arm.
"It's just a mechanical."
She pulls back the sheet to reveal a frighteningly lifelike mannequin, its mouth agape, eyes rolling.
"He's supposed to be in his death throes."
"How does it work?"
Will whispers.
"It's a wind-up toy."
"Who's been winding it up?"
"Well, that's the thing. You need to wind it only every few weeks. It sort of keeps going. It's unpredictable."
Will swallows.
"It's awful."
"I know. That's why people pay a dime to see it."
Will grimaces as the mechanical figure gives another choking gasp. Marin covers it and moves to another narrow table. She draws back the sheet to reveal a beautiful woman with long, raven-black hair. Her eyes are shut, but she looks utterly alive. The faintest whisper of breath escapes her ruby lips. Her chest rises and falls gently.
"We call this one Sleeping Beauty."
Will doesn't know which is eerier, the gurgling death gasp or the ghostly sigh of the eternal sleeper. Suddenly, Sleeping Beauty gives a very loud hiccup. Will laughs.
"She's not supposed to do that," Marin tells him. "Mr. Dorian's trying to fix her. He made a lot of the things in here."
Marin takes his hand and draws him deeper into the shadows of the room. Something murmurs inside a sealed trunk, and Will pauses.
"What's in there?"
"Indonesian night puppets. They're quite active. Not even Mr. Dorian's sure how they work. Don't open the lid. It's impossible to catch them once they start bouncing all over the place. Here, look at this."
She parts a curtain to reveal a large tank filled with murky green water. Bobbing inside is a bizarre skeleton. Some scales still cling to the ragged remains of a tail. Atop an algae-coated ribcage and crooked spine is a terrible skull with its lips pulled back. Abundant hair undulates in the water. Withered eyeballs cling to their sockets. A sign on the case says, "The Fiji Mermaid."
"Is it real?"
Will breathes.
"It's pretty hard to know what's real and what isn't sometimes. Especially around here."
In a cabinet's open drawer, Will spots a large, meaty hand with a bloody stump of a wrist.
"What's that?"
"Hmm? Oh, that's just to scare the kids. Touch it if you want."
Will pokes at it, and the hand immediately flips over and grabs his wrist. With a yelp, Will shakes it loose. The hand falls to the floor and scuttles about like a spider. Will's about to stamp on it when Marin pulls him back, laughing.
"Sorry, I couldn't resist."
Her voice takes on the tone of a circus spieler.
"This here is the hand of none other than Attila the Hun. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, preserved in a glacier in the mountains of China. Possessed eternally with the spirit of the savage warlord. Beware! Never turn your back, for he'll tighten his fingers around your neck."
The hand leaps out of sight.
"Oh, no. Can you see it?"
Marin asks. Will drops to the floor with her, but the hand has journeyed off underneath dusty crates.
"Lord knows where it'll end up now,"
she says.
"Never mind. We'll get it later."
There's a thud on the roof. Will looks up in alarm, following the footsteps from one end of the car to the other. After a moment, another person tramps overhead.
"Brogan,"
Marin says.
"There's lots of them,"
Will says, as yet more runners traverse the cars. He knows his disguise isn't finished. The black hair won't fool anyone.
"It's all right. They'll never find us in here," says Marin. "This way."
She hurries toward a tall mannequin dressed like a boxer. His arms are cocked, his fists raised protectively before his face. His jaw juts aggressively, eyes squinted. Marin lifts his shirt and turns a crank in his breastbone.
"What does he do?"
Will asks.
"What do you think?"
On the boxer's heavy metal base is written, "Beat our boxer and win a dollar." From within the boxer's chest comes the faintest ticking, which is quickly blotted out by more heavy footsteps on the roof. Merrin turns down the wick